Okay, hi everybody. This is the Laws of the Soul webinar commentary number 11. We are working in the book Esoteric Psychology, Volume 2, and perhaps it would serve just to take up the sentence we completed with at the end of commentary number 10 in the series. Just as the law of attraction working on the physical plane brought them together as men and women into one group effort, so the law of magnetic impulse can begin to control them when, again as a group and only as a group, I want to emphasize that, they unitedly constitute themselves channels for service in pure self-forgetfulness. The ideal here is high, but the standard is clearly presented, and if we want to work towards the kind of group work which must characterize disciples' efforts in the Aquarian age, then we have to follow these recommendations, at least to consistently make the attempt. Okay, so moving onward, we're on page 113 of Esoteric Psychology 2. This thought embodies, let's just see here. Yeah, I'll get that. This thought embodies the opportunity immediately before all groups of aspirants and allied men of goodwill in the world today. Perhaps we might say that the aspirants are a little in advance, that the fire burns more fiercely in them than in the average a good man or woman of goodwill. But they are allied, even though perhaps the men and women of goodwill, being filled with kindness of heart, do not know exactly the occult opportunities, the esoteric opportunities, which many of the aspirants do realize and understand. So if they work together as groups of souls, they can accomplish much, and we have to understand here that this does not mean groups of people, per se. Groups of souls. We have to realize ourselves as souls, see ourselves as souls, and realize that the nature of our cooperation is as a group of those who identify themselves as souls, as beings, as units of consciousness on the higher mental plane, minimally on the higher mental plane. And even were we to find our suprapersonal focus within the spiritual triad, we would still be groups of souls. There is that very interesting passage in the Letters on Occult Meditation which shows these interior groups. There it is. Okay. And I'd like to just point to Letters on Occult Meditation here. So you see these different groups of souls, groups of triads, groups of monads. Well, in terms of consciousness, they are all groups of souls. So I think this is, there's one page here, and I think it's page 39. Yes, it is. So here are these groups of souls, per se, at least within the causal body, on the first, on the second and third subplane. By the time we reach the first subplane, perhaps the causal body has been relinquished, but because we're dealing with units of consciousness, we can call them souls. And here on the Buddhic plane are other groupings on the third subplane, 28 groups. Shall we call them souls or triads? On the first subplane, 21 groups. What sorts of beings are these when, in fact, we understand that the kind of cities available on the first and second subplanes of the Buddhic and Atmic plane are pertinent to those who have achieved the grade beyond Master of the Wisdom. And then on the atomic subplane of the atmic plane, another 14 groups. What should we call them? Triads, souls. The true ego is the spiritual triad, we've been told, and then seven great groups of monads. But even the term soul, in the deeper sense, applies to the monadic level. A soul is a unit of consciousness, and that unit of consciousness can be found on any particular level in cosmos. Usually we limit the term by discussing a unit of consciousness within a vehicle consisting of matter of the second and third subplanes of the higher mental plane, the egoic body. But simply because we habitually limit the term soul does not mean that it should be thus limited to a deeper understanding. Okay. So if they work together as a group of souls, this is our opportunity, they can accomplish much. This thought illustrates also the significance of this law, which does produce polar union. Well, you know, at first when you look at such a term, you think of union between the poles, but they're all manner of poles. The soul and personality are polar, and the soul-infused personality is, should we say, negative to the positive monad, and on it may go, with the monad as negative to a greater including entity. Whether that is the entity that informs a series of monads, or whether it's the Sanakumara, or whether it's planetary logos, every entity that is, in some context, positive, does prove to be, in yet another and higher context, the receptive, the negative entity. What is needed to be grasped is that in this work, in this work, there is no personal ambition implied. There may be the will that the group succeed on behalf of the plan, but that the person succeed per se, divorced from association with the plan, that would be ambition, and that is not suggested. Here, not even of a spiritual nature, and no personal union is thought. The union is between factors that are higher than the personality level. Union between factors higher than the vehicles of the personality. This is not the mystical union of the scriptures or of the mystical tradition. This would still have personal connotations. And it is not, you know, it's so interesting that in this law, DK feels obliged to tell us so much what the law is not about. Because obviously our very first tendency is to begin thinking in habitual terms, customary terms, which are lower than the terms in which he would have us think. It is not alignment and union with a master's group, or fusion with one's inner band of pledged disciples, nor even with one's own ray life. And these are all very high possibilities. Polar union. So he's describing, and let's put this down, or even with one's own ray life, DK is describing what polar union is not. All these factors constitute preliminary implications and are of an individual application. We have to think what we would be as an individual unit of consciousness united with other such units of consciousness, other disciples within a master's group, even with our own ray life, which is a very high possibility. So upon this sentence, I ask you to ponder, It's the word individual that we have to watch out for, I think, because he's going to tell us something about a union which is not of individual application. The union is a greater and more vital thing because it is a group union. Not of the individual with a greater group, but of the group itself with, let us say, a still greater group. What we are seeking to do is to carry forward a group endeavor which is of such moment that at the right time it could produce in its growing momentum such a potent magnetic impulse or relationship initiatory energy current, such a potent magnetic impulse that it will reach those lives who brood over humanity and our civilization. Greater lives than the Masters of the Wisdom. We can call them the forces of light, and who work through the Masters of the Wisdom and the assembled hierarchy. Well, these, you know, of course, could easily be shambolic lives. We hear of the lights who carry out the will of God. I think in this seventh of the rules for disciples and initiates. This group endeavor will call forth from them. Group endeavor always. Beyond individual implication, as high as those implications may be, this type of polar union is beyond individual implications, as high as those individual implications may be. It's not about who we as an individual unite with or what we unite with. It's what we as a group and many of the larger groups can be included, can unite with. Eventually, it's about what humanity itself can unite with. So we want to, I think at the great festivals, we want to call down blessings and intervention and even the slightest attention from some of these greater groups. Hierarchy itself would be applying to them and would achieve a kind of polar union with them. This group endeavor will call forth from them a responsive and magnetic impulse. Well, let's call this impulse an initiatory energy current, which will bring together through the medium of all the aspiring groups the overshadowing beneficent forces. This group endeavor will call forth from them, and here we could mean those lives who brood over humanity and our civilization and who work through the Masters of the Wisdom. This group endeavor could call forth from them, the them in this case, I suppose, is the brooding ones, a responsive and magnetic impulse which will bring together through the medium of all the aspiring groups the overshadowing beneficent forces and bring these forces into manifestation. Through the concentrated effort of these groups in the world today, who constitute subjectively one group, in a way we could call this New Group of World Servers, light and inspiration and spiritual revelation can be released in such a flood of power that it will work definite changes in the human consciousness and help to ameliorate conditions in this needy world. So, a great act of invocation is needed to evoke these higher beneficent overshadowing forces, which can release into humanity that which humanity desperately needs. It's a great act of invocation that is needed, and I suppose we're working on that at the times of the full moon, and maybe it's during those times which groups of human beings can be particularly effective in touching these forces of light. We think about the three spiritual festivals, and here we have the forces of light that can be contacted at the Waysak Festival, the forces of restoration at the Aries Festival, the forces of reconstruction at the Gemini Festival, those great high forces which are not specified but are generalized. The title Forces Of is a generalization of what they are. And particularly at those times can these brooding, overshadowing, beneficent, culturing forces be evoked and release into humanity that which is needed. So what is needed is always available. It's always really present if we developed in group formation a sufficient point of tension to be truly invocative of the evocation possible. DK is holding before us a very promising possibility if humanity could but reorient itself, or at least if the aspirants and disciples of the world could be successful in this reorientation and bring about the reorientation in the lives of the men and women of goodwill. It will open men's eyes to the basic realities, which are high and subtle realities, really, and are mostly unknown, which are as yet only dimly sensed by the thinking public. You know, maybe generalized in such terms as the higher powers. Or, you know, as in the AA program, everyone has a higher power. It's not specified as it is in occultism. I think they stay away from too much specification. But there is something up there, in there, which has a great ability to release into the human consciousness forces which will change everything. Humanity itself must apply the necessary correctives, believing it can do so in the strength of its own sensed wisdom and strength. And this is even in the full moon days of preparation and days of distribution, there is a day, a final day of belief, when we have the firm conviction, the belief that all of this work has been effective and is now in greater, or contributing to the manifestation of better possibilities. Humanity itself must apply the necessary correctives, believing it can do so in the strength of its own sensed wisdom and strength. So we don't know all the particulars about our powers, but we sense that there is wisdom within us, there is strength within us, and we believe it can be effective, and we attempt to make our sensed wisdom and strength effective. Yet all the time behind the scenes stand the grouped world aspirants working silently, indeed, silently in unison with each other and the hierarchy, and thus keeping the channel open through which the needed wisdom, strength, and love can flow. So we aspirants and disciples of the world are the intermediaries between the higher powers and humanity arising in its strength and wisdom towards the proper invocative attitude. We have to realize, remember, how very responsible we are to keep that channel open. Everything we do will contribute to the passage of the higher energies to the lower, and the more, or take from it, and the more we remain steadfastly in group, soul, relationship, the better type of intermediary we become, the group intermediary. There are therefore to be found in this great task the following relations and groupings. These must be considered and are as follows. And these are the specifics, the forces of light and the spirit of peace. The forces of light are discussed in relation to the very first of the great invocations, that the forces of light bring illumination to mankind. The spirit of peace, which is, I think, now a super shambolic being, an extraplanetary being. The forces of light, let us see, embody lives of tremendous group potency, and we can look here in Discipleship in the New Age, Volume 2. There are 9 references to the forces of light. The forces of light driving the forces of evil back and of aggression back to their dark habitation. Sounds very dramatic, and I suppose if we really knew all about it, it would be. Okay, so let's see. The conflict between the forces of light and the forces of evil. This is the energy of the forces of light originating in the ashram and emanating thence. So there are forces of light within the ashram itself. This is a generic term, but I think we're speaking of forces that hover even above the ashramic level. The forces of light here are triumphing over the forces of evil. The time of restoration opens up. Okay. Let's see. Therefore, through the forces of light, liberation into freedom will come. There was a definite place here where the high status of the forces of light was discussed. Be in the hands of the forces of light. Okay. We do seem, I'm not sure that I'm really finding this the way I hope to, but let the forces of light bring illumination to mankind. The forces of light bring illumination. Well, let's just see here. Bring, okay, it should be a discipleship. Bring illumination. Oh, that's being. Bring illumination. Here we go. So, bring illumination. Let the spirit of peace be spread abroad. Let's try that. Spirit of peace be spread abroad. And, okay. Okay, I think I found what I'm looking for, at least part of it. And this is about the forces of light from the externalization of the hierarchy. The first phrase, let the forces of light bring illumination to mankind, definitely invokes potencies which are to be found upon monadic levels of consciousness and upon what is occultly called the second plane of divine manifestation. That's such an important idea. These forces include the Lord of the World and the representatives of the 7 sacred planets who are spoken of in the Christian Bible as the 7 spirits before the throne. And they also include the 3 agents of the divine triplicity, which are known esoterically in the East as the 3 Kumaras, or as the three Buddhas of activity? What do these names and these great individualities mean to you and to average humanity? Nothing at all. And this is necessarily so, but they remain but names and possible hypothetical expressions of divinity until after the third initiation, when the conscious recognition of the monad becomes possible. Then forces and energies personified for us in these great and stupendous lives can be demonstrated as having true existence. Well, anyway, we see that they are high indeed. Let's see here. That the forces of light bring illumination to mankind. The intermediary is the hierarchy. The agent is the Buddha. The expression is light and understanding. Place of emphasis is the second or monadic plane. And it looks like the spirit of peace is involved here with the logoic or first plane. How very interesting. Then to the Buddhic, then to the astral. So the spirit of peace seems to have even a higher origin and to involve itself in the logoic plane. Anyway, it is very worthwhile to have this compilation on the forces of light, because they can mean some very high sources, sources which we do not expect. Okay. Yes. All right, so that's just a little diversion, and it was not only in the book Discipleship in the New Age, as I had thought, but in fact, from the monadic plane, and then from the logoic plane, the forces of light and the spirit of peace, and the spirit of peace, if we have a compilation on that, I think we will find that spirit to be not shambolic at all, but even an extraplanetary spirit. Certainly the avatar of synthesis is. Embodied lives of tremendous group potency. And there may be a hint there, because so many of these higher lives are really, in a sense, unitary and composite. The higher lives are both unitary and composite. That reaches a point when aggregated, we will find ourselves a many who is yet a one. And that really is, of course, the universal logos, ultimately. It is the ultimate many in any universe, and yet the one. So, a little bit of a diversion here in the conversational mode. I hope you can put up with that a little bit. The planetary hierarchy comes next. Great relations and groupings, the planetary hierarchy. The Buddha now focusing within Shambhala, the Christ within hierarchy, the new group of world servers consisting largely of initiates of the second degree and beyond, and humanity as a whole. You will notice that the Buddha focuses in himself the downpouring forces, while the Christ focuses in himself the outgoing demand. So the Christ is, in a way, the agent of invocation, and he evokes the forces for which the Buddha is the agent. So you will note that the Buddha focuses in himself the downpouring forces, whilst the Christ focuses in himself the outgoing demand and the spiritual aspirations of the entire planet. And this is particularly noted at the festival of Gemini, the Christ festival, when the Christ focuses within himself the entire aspiration of humanity, and the Buddha also participates in this. The two of them together under Gemini are the two brothers. They represent the East and the West, and they represent, in a way, Shambhala and also hierarchy. The Buddha representing Shambhala and the Christ representing hierarchy, although, of course, the Christ is as well a member of Shambhala. So this makes a planetary alignment of great potency. Should the needed work be accomplished, the needed adjustments in the world can be made. So when we talk about solving world problems, we must not forget the role which the vertical dimension plays in this solution. The success or failure lies largely in the hands of those scattered but spiritually aligned men and women whom we call the New World Servers. This is the great intermediary grouping. So, the forces of light, the spirit of peace, they are all ready to respond, but they need the intermediary. And interestingly, you know, you look at rays representing the intermediary, the second and fourth rays represent the intermediary, and the new group of world servers is a fourth ray group, which is very allied to the forces of light. They are allied to Taurus, and the forces of light must necessarily be allied to Taurus at the time of the Waysak Festival. It is the forces of light or illumination which are the most powerful. That's the Taurian festival, and Taurus is bringing in the fourth ray. So we can see those correlations. All of us, I think, are involved as students of occultism in gradually making the correlations which will reveal all of the interrelationships in unity within our particular sphere, whether it's the planetary sphere, solar systemic sphere, cosmic sphere, beyond. So gradually we are like Isis, putting the pieces back together, and the Isis act occurs in consciousness as we make these mercurial correlations, Isis being Sirius, and Sirius being the star of Mercury, or Mercury the star of Sirius. How does it go? I think, we'll find that in esoteric astrology. Mercury, star, Sirius, and let's see, there it is. It is the star of Mercury or Buddha. Sirius is the star, it was the star of Mercury. Well, there's a strong correlation there between the Isis function and the correlative or correlating mercurial function. In the above tabulation, there is portrayed a little of what is implied in the words, the law of polar union, because these great sources are related to each other in a polar relationship. The shambolic force is positive to the planetary hierarchy. Maybe the planetary hierarchy, well, the Buddha as a whole, in Great Sacrifice, looks like he is representing these forces of light, but they can be beyond the planetary level. The Buddha, in a way, is the positive aspect to the receptive Christ, the Christ to the new group of world servers, the new group of world servers positive to humanity, and so forth. So there are various polarities here which are going to be fused. And this is not a formal process. It's a process which concerns consciousness. This is key. We almost have to ponder on every word the Tibetan writes, because he writes with such care, and so frequently he tells us how little proper attention we give to his words and how lacking in accuracy is our understanding, consequently. The whole process concerns consciousness and the results worked out in consciousness with the physical plane happenings dependent upon the conscious realization of the men of goodwill in or out of in or out of the new group of world servers. There are men and women of goodwill, of course, that are not per se in the new group of world servers. They are rightly oriented, however, to be in the new group of world servers indicates, I think, a higher status. But first consciousness and then the results inform. That's the idea, isn't it? And then the results inform. That is the the order of the process. So as we improve our consciousness, results will follow, improved conditions will follow in our form life, and thus it will be for all of humanity. So those of us who are working for the elevation of human consciousness are also working for the elevation of the human formal condition. We are trying to better material circumstances for humanity by first improving the quality of consciousness. It's a bit like when human beings are properly educated, a better world from the circumstantial angle will follow. This work, carried forward successfully and intelligently, should make it possible to inaugurate a new relation between hierarchy and mankind. And, you know, as those who are men and women of goodwill and disciples of all kinds and members of the new group of world servers, we are attempting to stand as intermediaries to bring about this new relation. We stand as intermediaries to bring about this new relation between hierarchy and humanity. The second ray, of course, is a ray of relationship, the primary ray of relationship and of intermediary capability, intermediating capability, and this is the second law. This effort could mark, and let us hope it will, the beginning of a new type of mediatory work. Interestingly, somewhat, we're in the role of Pisces here, not only of Aquarius or Taurus, because Pisces is the sign of mediatorship. I think we see that if we go to page 333 here and we go down here into this important tabulation. We see Pisces, the medium, the mediator, and the savior. On the way to becoming the savior, one becomes the mediator. Alice Bailey had thought that she had a strong Pisces component to her chart. Others who have rectified her chart do not feel that is the case. The Gemini maybe would have been sufficient because Pisces and Gemini have so much in common in a way. Her chart has been rectified as having Leo rising, and most people tend to agree with that, most astute astrologers. But anyway, here we have sensitivity to soul, which is the function of the mediator, and that is under Pisces. And we can thereby see that Neptune has a strong mediatory function as well. Neptune being maybe the highest ruler of Pisces in a special sense, where humanity is concerned as a whole. So this effort could mark, and let us hope it will, I mean, you know, this was written 80 years ago. Let us see whether it has. I think the Christ has his hands full at the moment, doing all he can to avert a so-called final war. The opponents are facing off, as it were. And let us hope that the next 12 years or so before 2025 sees that that war did not materialize in full potential. In fact, that the forces building up were somehow canalized, channeled into more constructive possibilities, more constructive manifestations. But the forces are definitely building, and it's the forces between the lower aspect of humanity, its subdiaphragmatic chakras, and its superdiaphragmatic chakras. It's a battle between, it's about humanity reversing the wheel, really. Humanity is the disciple and can be in the process of reversing the wheel and can become, in a sense, the initiate under the Christ energy. And that is the great battle between, featuring so many of the Martian, Vulcanian, Plutonian forces at this time. So, a new type of mediatory work, a work carried forward by the salvaging group of servers. That's the bridge, isn't it, towards salvation. We realize that the new group of world servers is training in saviorship. First the server under Aquarius, then the savior under Pisces. a work carried forward by a salvaging group of servers who are in training for the establishing of that group which will eventually save the world under the law of sacrifice. I guess we have the embryonic condition of the new group of world servers at this time, but we are looking for a saving group. It's Christ the Savior, his church, which are the masters, and the saving group known as the New Group of World Servers, which assists the Great Lord and will increasingly assist him during the Aquarian Age. This mediatory work, however, involves the recognition of the law of magnetic impulse. It's an impulse is generally a first ray kind of operation. It is related to the idea of initiative. It's the sending forth of energy which induces magnetism. Let's call it that. The sending forth of a stream of energy which induces magnetism, of a cohering kind, bringing the many positive groups together. So it involves the recognition of the law of magnetic impulse and a desire to understand it and to cooperate with those who wield it. And those who wield it are evoked and are bringing together the lesser groups, the lesser positively inclined groups in the world to serve as a medium of transmission of the energies which the great ones impulse or send, let's just say send. So this is the sending forth of a stream of energy which induces magnetism, which brings the positively inclined groups together so that they can more successfully serve as media for the transmission of the great energies which are focused in the higher dimensions where these forces of light make their home or find their domain. So through its medium, through the medium of the law of magnetic impulse and the right understanding of the law, see, it's all about a law of relationship, a law of relationship with higher energies, and let's just say a law of group relationship with higher energies, which are necessarily in group formation on their own high plane. Which. It should be possible then to establish the needed union between the liberated souls, who are in themselves the symbol of the soul in all forms, and the souls in prison. Now this is the function, this is the purpose, a relationship between liberated souls and souls still imprisoned in the form. And we know now that the great second ray of our planet is beginning to express itself, and the coming of the Christ is a representation of the expression of the planetary soul, and the planetary soul seeks, on its own high plane, seeks to draw forth, magnetically draw forth, out of the prison of form, the imprisoned souls. The time has come when many human beings can be drawn forth into a higher type of soul expression, and all the soul within the lesser kingdoms of nature can be raised to still freer expression, though still within form. So the initiation is the releasing from prison of the imprisoned souls. And we have a great opportunity for humanity with the coming first initiation of humanity, a certain proportion of humanity, to release into greater expression the souls which had been imprisoned in the lunar vehicles. All of this is done through inter-soul magnetism, let's say. All of this is accomplished through inter-soul magnetism. The magnetism between units of consciousness and between large group units of consciousness and other lesser units of consciousness. It's soul-to-soul magnetism. That's really what we have to have in mind. It's not about the form. Soul-to-soul magnetism, not about the form. Though in some ways, of course, what we habitually call soul could from a higher perspective be considered form, but we get the idea, attraction between the units of consciousness per se, between the consciousnesses per se. Much of the success of this planned endeavor, I suppose much of it was to be accomplished in the 20th century, and certainly we have still a little time. If occultism is to win the day by the end of the 21st century, spiritual occultism, we mean, much of the success of this planned endeavor depends upon the intellectual grasp of the members of the new group of world servers in connection with the necessary technique. So we have to be academically trained to understand how this law of magnetic impulse really works. Notice, you know, think for a moment of how he described these laws in A Treatise on Cosmic Fire. It was a different way of elaborating the point, and he did not descend so much into the practicalities, the practical psychology of humanity, as he does in this book. So we are grateful for this elaboration. We do realize that A Treatise on Cosmic Fire was the seed of so many other other things to come, Treatise on White Magic, Esoteric Psychology, Esoteric Astrology, I suppose some of the healing factors were found there as well, but particularly the books I mentioned. Okay, I have to keep my eyes open because occasionally the internet disconnects, and that can mean that I'm not recording what I think I am, but hopefully we don't have too much of a hiatus here, maybe none at all. So this is a planned process to apply the law of magnetic impulse, the law of polar union, the union between entities polarized in different dimensions and which have a polar relationship to each other, either of a positive or a negative kind, and therefore to unite the poles, and ultimately, I suppose, to unite Shambhala with its manifestation in the dense physical body of the solar and planetary logos. So the intellectual grasp of the members of the new group of world servers in connection with this necessary technique. It will depend also upon their willingness, that's us, that's who we are. We have to be willingness to accept the idea of the opportunity, and upon their readiness to work along the indicated lines. So therefore, these lines must be publicized so that people can come to realize the opportunity. They have no guarantee as to the accuracy of the claims made regarding the importance of this period. Let us hope that our intuition reveals the truth of what Master D.K. is teaching us. We do have to work with faith, and faith is related to the imagination and to the intuition, under also the law of recognition. If there is that within us which is burning fiercely enough, or has reached a high enough point of vibration, it will resonate with the quality of the teachers. We cannot prove the veracity of what the teachers teach, but there's something within us that resonates to what they are saying and to what they are. And it's often this willingness to work without proof that establishes our value to them. It's like the old story of the student that begged the master to reveal a miracle, because really, you know, deep down the student did not believe in the teacher. So reveal a miracle so that I can believe in you. So reluctantly, after much importuning, the teacher did perform a miracle, and the student was impressed and said, "Ah, now I believe in you. I'm ready to work." And then the teacher was forced to say, "Yes, but now I don't need you anymore." So we have to have that intuitive resonance with the higher sources, which reveals to us the veracity for which they stand and which they are. So there is no guarantee as to the accuracy of claims made regarding the importance of this period, nor have they, that is we, any personal knowledge of the situation as it is here described. Certainly the soul of humanity. Some do not even know that there is a watching hierarchy. But they, the members of the new group, and also men and women of goodwill, are consecrated and selfless souls, and as such belong to the new group of world service. If you are a consecrated and selfless soul, I wonder if he's using the term new group of world service in a technical sense, pretty much indicating initiates of the second degree beyond, or whether he's using it in a broader and general sense as the subjective group of all those who are deeply involved in selfless service. It's almost as if, well, let's just say, you know, if we imagine that he's using the term technically to indicate initiates of the second degree and beyond, then we can say every second degree initiate must be a consecrated and selfless soul, which is maybe another way of describing the second initiation. And as such belong to the new group of world service. If they can aspire, pray, meditate, and serve, focusing always in unison with all other services in the one sound, in the one note of the soul, we might say the unison, in the one note of the soul, with, of course, its many subsidiary notes, all included in that one, basically, second-ray note. If they can aspire, pray, meditate, and serve, focusing always in unison with all other servers, the salvaging of humanity will go forward with much greater speed than heretofore. And to this call, many will respond. Well, we've been told that we could slow the process down by some hundreds of years. It's been hinted that we could slow the process by some thousands of years. And let us hope that that is not the case, and that the promise of the age of Aquarius is fulfilled, and that it is not the age of regimentation and distribution of that which is of a lower and imprisoning nature. Any energy can be positively or negatively used, so we have to earn our optimism for the age of Aquarius. We have to make it possible for the good to emerge with the tremendous potentials. Of course, the intention of the Christ to reappear and the externalization of hierarchy, I think those movements are in the works, and for those reasons, there is not too much to fear for the state of humanity. We've not been told that the Christ will not be able to appear or that the hierarchy will not be able to externalize. We've been told that they will. Of course, there could be a delay in when that happens, according to how many respond to the opportunity here presented under the law of magnetic impulse, which basically asks us to live the life of the soul and to relate to each other as souls and as groups together to invoke the great group lives who hold the salvation of humanity and the planet within themselves and can release the energies that will bring about that redemption, salvation that is so needed. We certainly look around at the world condition and we see the incredible need for redemption and salvation. It's quite extraordinary. There's so much coming to the surface under the action of Pluto, dragging everything to the surface for all to see, and in the horror of that sight, people set their will and their resolution to do something about it. That's what we have done, I'm sure. For the individual disciple, the significance of this law of magnetic impulse and the corresponding relationships in his own life might be shown in tabulated form. Well, of course, at first, the real law does not so much deal with the individual as with groups of souls, but there will be an individual reflection. So the implications, the corresponding relationships in his own life might be as follows. The world of souls on the higher mental plane, consciousness will develop of this world of souls, and he will find himself a member of the world of souls. The master of his group, the ashram, will be revealed as a collection of souls. Of course, the ashram is primarily on the Buddhic plane at this time, but there are aspects of it on the mental plane. It's hard to know whether this is really going up or down, because the master is focused on the cosmic ethers, and the souls are very much found on triadal levels, but maybe this was written sometime before that was really so much confirmed. The solar angel also is basically a Buddhic being or a being beyond, though an aspect of itself is focused on the higher mental plane, and in a way the solar angel is a being above the master, but and above the world of souls on the higher mental plane. It's minimally Buddhic. It has come from a previous solar system altogether and was a human being at that time. We're definitely moving downward now. The aspiring disciple on the lower mental planes and the personality integrated and off troublesome also on the lower mental levels, and then the environing associates. These are factors which will be reflectively related under the law of magnetic impulse. But implied here is something of the Buddhic level, where the master will be found, and the master of most ashrams, and where the solar angel will also be found, except for its extension into the higher mental levels. So as individuals, we take these factors into consideration when considering how the law of magnetic impulse will reflect into our individual lives. It is useful for students to have these analogies in mind, for they can often arrive at release from the limitations of their lives and at a truer comprehension of the larger issues when they see that their little unimportant lives, he always is giving us that sense of proportion, are only the reflection of greater and more important factors. So let's just say a larger perspective will bring release of the consciousness. And that is what we struggle for. Well, we're going to move on here, and we'll continue this. We're pretty much at the 1 hour mark, but we will continue and maybe make this a 2 hour program unless it ends this section earlier. So we have analogies. We saw the higher series, the forces of light, the planetary hierarchy, the Buddha, the Christ, the new group world service, humanity as a whole, and then the individual reflection, the world of souls on the higher mental plane, the master of his group, the solar angel. The angel of the presence, in a way, from one perspective, can be considered a somewhat concretized expression of the solar angel. The angel of the presence is kind of the doorway to monadic realization. And it sometimes I'm inclined to think that the angel of the presence is that part of the solar angel which has been invested on the higher mental plane. The real solar angel, a more liberated being, who always stands within the presence, either of its own monad or in communication with the monad of the human being that it is serving. But the angel of the presence is, in a way, the investment of the solar angel upon the higher mental plane and guards the door into the world of being for the aspiring projected monad. We are all projected monads. We've been downwardly projected as units of consciousness into the lower worlds, and as we begin to rise, we encounter the angel of the presence, which is, in a way, the angel with the flaming sword, and determines when we shall penetrate that disk of golden light and enter the presence itself. So when the solar angel finally withdraws and returns to the heart of the sun, it withdraws that part of itself which I've been calling the angel of the presence. There's so many different ways to look at this, you know, and I've never yet seen that any disciple who's my friend and associate and acquaintance has the final say on what is the solar angel and what is the angel of the presence. DK comes at it from so many different perspectives. But I think if we begin to study, as we have, I've done those sections on the old commentary concerning the angel of the presence, we begin to see that we may need a name for that part of the solar angel which is not free on its own higher planes, but is invested in the higher mental plane. And I think maybe, although that part is still the solar angel, maybe that part can be called, with some degree of accuracy, the angel of the presence. At least that's my temporary take on the matter, at my own present level of ignorance, until the day comes when a higher understanding is mine. And then I'll try to convey that. We can only convey illumination to the degree we have it, and we must convey that which we do have, realizing always that it's just a partial illumination compared to the still greater light which will be ours and which already is achieved by beings, or even human beings higher than ourselves, and other beings still higher than human beings. Okay, so this is the individual reflection. And we do want to arrive at a release from the limitations of our lives and what Master DK has been so able to give us, a truer comprehension of the larger issues. Just think what cosmic fire can mean to us in terms of that, or the book, The Rays and the Initiations. Really, all through his books, we are being given a master's sense of perspective, at least the possibility of stepping into that more than we were ever able to without such a gift. And we will then begin to look at all of our immediate activities and life interactions in terms of that, of the larger issues. And maybe that will make a difference. We will be released, I think, from our usual reactivity to immediate issues, because we see through the use of the soul illumined mind and the triadally illumined mind the larger picture, the larger issues. And our lives are little and unimportant. You know, at first we may think the world revolves around us, and we do go through that Leonian stage when we are very much at the center of our own content of consciousness. The, what we call the lower ego really absorbs most of it, with just a little bit that is peripheral. And you sometimes see this, you know, with people at this stage who are showing forth what they are and how large they loom within their own field of consciousness. But this is a stage, and we've all been through it, and probably in the recapitulation of lives in the earlier part of our life, we go through a stage when we are recapitulating that, however long or short that may be. So there are greater and more important factors. It is wise always to remember that the plane of soul existence, on the plane of soul existence, there is no separation. Know my soul and thy soul. The macrocosmic whole is all there is. Let the disciple, the group, no longer use the term my soul and thy soul. Let's get the exact words there from the fifth rule, maybe page 21 or so. Yes, the macrocosmic whole is all there is. Let the group perceive that whole and then no longer use the thought, my soul and thine. So even on the plane of soul, certainly on the plane of triad, we would begin to realize this to be the case. The individual factors which have contributed to the egoic lotus are looming larger on the plane of higher mind than they would if the consciousness were liberated into the field of the spiritual triad. But still, even on the plane of soul existence, of course, does he mean the higher mental plane? Because he says, you know, the true, the triad is the true ego. But I think pretty much we can consider that the higher mental plane is the plane of soul existence, as usually considered. It is only in the three worlds of illusion and of Maya, and all of them are illusion and Maya, even though we relegate illusion to the mental plane, glamour to the astral, and Maya to the etheric physical plane. They are all illusion, glamour, Maya. The great Maya, the Mahamaya, it's even the cosmic physical plane from a greater cosmic perspective. It is only in the three worlds of illusion and of Maya that we think in terms of souls and bodies. We have to develop that subtle state of consciousness which reveals what DK says here to be true. Words are just words until we have proven their truth to ourselves. So it is wise always to remember that on the plane of soul existence there is no separation, no my soul and thy soul. I sometimes think if we could simply overcome the sense of separation, we would be doing a very great thing in our lives. To overcome the great, let's put a heresy of separateness, would be a great accomplishment. And we could forego the accumulation of much knowledge, could we but accomplish this, the overcoming of the great heresy of separateness. This is an occult platitude and well-known, but the re-emphasis of the well-known truth will sometimes serve to bring home to you its exactitude. Well, the truth is the truth to those for whom it is a truth. For many of us, platitude is simply a statement of what a higher consciousness perceives to be truth, and we have not yet made these platitudes our own truths. And when we have made a platitude, transformed a platitude into a truth, it is in a way no longer a platitude to us. It may be a platitude, oh, I've heard that before, to people to whom we might speak it. But we have transformed it into a truth. So There's so many platitudes that our mind may be filled with, and the business of transforming these statements that, quote, everybody knows about that, transforming them into truths is something the disciple must set himself to accomplish. Anyway, know my soul and thine, know my soul and thy soul. Every once in a while that happens, doesn't it? I mean, you know, there are high moments when it just melts away, and this funny thing called differentiation, or the presentation of difference as if it were a reality, just melts away. So often we perceive difference as if it were real, and then there come those special times at increasingly frequent intervals, let us hope and pray, when the presentation of difference as reality is lifted and difference is seen as a non-reality. There may be distinction, but no difference. There is distinction of perception, but the distinctions are all occurring within the one perceived being, the one perceived essence. The second illustration, which may perhaps make clearer the meaning and purpose of this law, we just saw the possibility of uniting the great souls with the souls in prison. That was one purpose. So let's remind ourselves, a previous purpose was to unite the world of free souls with those of the world of imprisoned souls. The second illustration, which may perhaps make clear the meaning and purpose of this law, and which will be of deep interest to esotericists, is to be found in connection with the symbol that specifies this law in the sacred records and in the archives of the lodge. Now, wouldn't you like to get into that library? Well, what kind of library card do we need to get into that library? What, a certified Master of Wisdom card, or at least an Arhat card? Well, when it's necessary for us to penetrate the arcana stored in that library for service purposes in line with the plan, the librarian will let us in. Meanwhile, DK is a marvelous representation of the contents of that library, giving to us what we have to take our next steps. So it is a symbol of two balls of fire and a triangle. And the triangle. And, you know, where are those balls of fire? Are they on two of the vertices of the triangle? This has not only a planetary and cosmic significance, but has a very definite relation to the individual unfoldment in the physical body of the spiritual disciple, the spiritual life of the disciple. So, yes, there are, you know, sometimes you look at the sign Scorpio and you realize that the claws of the scorpion, pretty much in the form of a triangle, was made into the constellation Libra, which is triangular, interestingly enough. Now, when you look at some of these, maybe not so much the sign constellation Cancer, I'd have to study that a little more closely, but when you look at Capricorn, the constellation Capricorn, it's in the form of a triangle. It's a great third ray constellation. Look at the constellation Libra. It's also a triangle, and it is another of the great third ray constellation, the outpicturing of the inner meaning in visual configuration is present. As Alice Bailey said, you know, if we lost all of the world's scriptures, we'd still have the sky, and we'd still be able to reconstruct the great path of evolution for humanity. So, not just planetary, not just cosmic, but also related, I think, pretty much to the Ajna Center, and maybe also to the other, let's see. Let me put it very simply. students know that there are in the head two centers, the adjunct center and the head center. So he's going to use both of them here. Two balls of fire, symbolic of the fiery consciousness of the soul and not of the animal consciousness in the body. Well, if the true soul, in a way, is the spiritual triad, and interestingly enough, related to Libra, a triangle there related to triangular Libra, if that is the case, then the adjunct center certainly must be related to soul and not only to body, and we certainly know the head center is. So we have two balls of fire. They do have to be connected. It's a bit like connecting the Sun and Venus or Vulcan and Venus. They're symbolic of the fiery consciousness of the soul and solar fire, and not of the animal consciousness of the body, which is the fire by friction consciousness. So different types of consciousness are related to the different DFT, different fires, which is obvious, but we can pause to realize that when we have body personality consciousness, it's fire by friction consciousness. When we have soul consciousness, it's solar fire consciousness. When we enter into whatever we want to call the consciousness of the monad, awareness, consciousness, whatever, it is electric fire consciousness. Consciousness characterized by the presence of electric fire. So anyway, there are two balls of fire. Okay. From another perspective, I mean, you can look at the adjunct center and the two petals can be considered to be balls of fire in their own way, a lesser way. These two centers externalize by the two glands, the pineal and the pituitary body. So the pineal for the head center and the pituitary body for the adjunct center become vibrant and alive and intensely active through service and meditation and right aspiration. Those are the keys. Here is an idea of chakra development. If these two centers are to become real balls of fire, vibrantly alive and intensely active, service is the way, meditation is the way, right aspiration is the way, and I don't think we should leave study out either. That's another triangle. Meditation, service, and study. We have two of them here. A line of contact between them is eventually set up and established with increasing potency. DK interestingly did talk about the cleavage between the two as one of the causes of migraine headaches. The cleavage between the head center and the adjunct center causes migraines, interestingly enough. Well, pain is the result of cleavage. So obviously there's some sort of overly focused concentration there and improper distribution. So a line of contact between them is eventually set up and established with increasing potency. Okay. There is also another line of outgoing fiery power at the top of the spinal column. This seems very much to be the triangle in the head. We're talking about the alto major center. You know, this triangle in the head has to be established for the magnetic radiance to go forth. It's one of the laws or rules of healing. You know, let's just look at that. Let's see. Through magnetic purity, the healer must achieve magnetic purity through purity of life. He must attain that dispelling radiance which shows itself in every man when he has linked the centers in the head. That's a triangle. When this magnetic field is established, the radiation It says the radiation 2 goes forth. I think that's a mistake. I think the radiation then goes forth. Sometimes in the transferring to the AABC CD-ROM, words are used, but they're not the correct word, and the spell checker doesn't catch them because they are actually words. The radiation, I think, then goes forth. Yes, the radiance says the radiance then goes forth, and instead of radiation, radiance. So there are obviously some variations in the words. The radiation too goes forth. The radiation then goes forth. There are three different ways of putting it: radiance, radiation, and so forth. But I think we get the idea. Establish the triangle in the head, and the radiation then goes forth. So there is also another line of outgoing fiery power towards the top of the spinal column. As the life of the soul gets stronger, the radiance of the centers increases, and the periphery of their sphere of influence is set up, creating a dual magnetic field. Now, how can we look at this duality? We have a triangle here between the head center, the alta major, and the ajna center. And we have a relationship between the head center and the ajna center. And we have some dual relationships, but they look like there are going to be three dual relationships between ajna and alta major, between ajna and head center, and between head center and alta major. So the periphery of their sphere of influence is set up, creating a dual magnetic field. Speaking esoterically, they are magnetically impelled towards each other. Now, there's such a big hint there, because the great groups of liberated souls and the groups of souls in prison are magnetically also impelled towards each other. The forces of light in Shambhala, kind of a head center, and the imprisoned souls, perhaps we could look at them as symbolically the Alta Major Center, they are impelled towards each other. And certainly in this particular case, the spiritual hierarchy would represent to the head center of Shambhala the Ajna Center. So there's going to be a connection between all of these different centers, and perhaps that's why we call two fiery balls and a triangle. Okay. Speaking esoterically, they are magnetically impelled towards each other and towards the stored up energy to be found in the spine. So the kundalini rising, which has been fired by friction, rising to the top of the spine where the alta major is its repository. They are impelled towards each other and towards the energy stored up in the spine, which probably becomes a fiery ball as well, and localized in the five centers up the spine. But localized there, but probably taken further to the alta major center. Eventually, the interplay is so powerful that a triangle of force appears within the radius of the magnetic field, and this triangle of light, of living fire, links the three Laya centers. So, oftentimes with Libra, you find that there is a triangularization. You have two that are united by one. Well, you know, in a way, the Ajna Center shows that. Or in the resolution of any two polarities, there is a higher point which resolves. But in this particular case, it looks as if the triangles are uniting all the three centers. So the two fiery balls, apparently, are the head center and the Ajna Center. You kind of wonder why it doesn't say three fiery balls, but at least they start as two. And a triangle. Two fiery balls and a triangle. The symbol is then completed, and the indication is that the disciple is now controlled by the subjective side of his nature, and this would mean the third initiation, the first truly subjective initiation, or at least when there is soul consciousness achieved at will. So the symbol is then completed. Of course, we're not entirely given the symbol, because there are only two fiery balls and one triangle. I think, you know, eventually we'll have to have the three, which would indicate the possibility of the third initiation via the triangle. And at that third initiation, the triad can then be more successfully approached. See how all these threes fit together. Sometimes the soul itself is called the triangle, and the dimension of souls, world of souls, the triangles. So he is now governed by the law of magnetic impulse as the linking of the head centers demonstrates. And we can ask, shall we include the Alta Major Center as a head center? In a way it is. The throat center is not, and there is a gap there. But at the base of the skull is this Alta Major Center, and it's still within the head. And the two aspects of his nature, higher and lower, which constitute the two poles with which he is concerned, are now united. So this is not yet about the union of the soul-infused personality with the monadic vehicle, but rather of the union of the soul and personality, which are the first two poles contacted, and then eventually the soul-infused personality proves to be the receptive part, and then the monad the positive part, and another polar union will be brought about, as I have been, you know, kind of indicating, definitely indicated at one point. So here we have a more occult understanding of the law of polar union, not just the uniting of the world of liberated souls with the world of imprisoned souls, but here are the technicalities of how this is done. He's governed by the law of magnetic impulse. When the evidence that he is governed by that is this linking in the head, which probably can be felt and probably experienced in consciousness. And the two aspects of his nature, higher and lower, and in this case, we mean soul and personality, which constitute the two poles with which he is concerned at this time of his development, later he'll be concerned with the monad, are now united. So we have, this is kind of a transfigurative moment, really, isn't it? Transfigurative moment. Transfiguration. The polar union has been brought about. So it's always, let's just say, uniting two as one. And this is what the second ray always does. It takes opposites, polarities, and it brings them into unity. It brings them into a state of oneness. Not yet perhaps into a state of homogeneity, but into a state of articulated oneness. The subject of this magnetic interplay offers food for thought and indicates the way of group and of individual service. We can say that every group must find its higher pole and be united with its higher pole. We can see this also relates to the union of Shambhala hierarchy and humanity, which would represent head, the head center, the Ajna center in this case, and the Alta Major Center, or from another perspective, head, heart, and throat. But keeping it within the head, we would have the three head centers which Shambhala hierarchy and humanity represent. So this is all about union, this whole law, and achieving a true union, not a secondary or artificial union, or, well, everything is temporary in that sense, but I was saying the more temporary unions that we have here in the dense world are perhaps steps along the way to this more subjective union which the individual can experience, but which is even more pertaining to group unions. As the individual aspirants lose sight of self in service. And as they arrive at the stage of indifference to personality claims and happenings, and that divine indifference again, you know, we might say that, I want to put this in, divine indifference achieved at the third initiation, they learn to cherish a spirit of confidence. Of course, he hints towards the monad here. The spirit of confidence comes from the spirit. I mean, when we realize ourselves as the internal immortal God, we are really under the influence or acting as the monad in incarnation. They learn to cherish a spirit of confidence, of joy, and of love, deep and lasting for each other. What a high realization for those involved in group work. Yes, they learn to cherish a spirit of confidence, of joy, and of love, deep and lasting for each other. This is such an ideal for us, something that we really want to develop, and we're on our way toward developing it, and it does develop in work, you know. I mean, when we work together on a project we all love and we immerse ourselves in it and don't think about the impact of that work upon our personality, then these attitudes, these realizations, these ways of regarding each other do develop. So we learn to cherish a spirit of confidence, of joy, and of love, deep and lasting for each other. Confidence in each other, joy in each other's presence, and deep and lasting love for each other. They learn to work together wholeheartedly for the helping of the world and the assistance of the hierarchy. It's so beautiful. And wholeheartedly, and this means, you know, obviously not half-heartedly. You sometimes think that Master Mori would rather encounter a true full-blooded enemy than a half-hearted cooperator. He talks about the halfwayness and the halfway ones who sort of crawl like worms on the battlefield. Whoa. Gives you the impression that we have to integrate ourselves, preferably for good, but you even kind of wonder if those who have integrated themselves negatively don't stand a better chance of being redeemed, because at least they've thrown their whole self into it. I remember reading this Bulwer Lytton novel about Zanoni. He was obviously an initiate. It's a wonderful kind of gothic, occult, esoteric novel. My first teacher told me about that book, and somehow years later I did pick it up. It's in a way a chilling read, because it reveals to you all of the kind of stuff that's going on around us in the inner worlds, and from which we are best filtered, we might say. And this book spoke of the opportunity that a man who had turned towards the left-hand path, the opportunity that he had at a specific moment. He was very dedicated to his own ego, and he sought to prepare a poison drink for the protagonist of this novel. Of course, being initiated as it was, it didn't have any effect on him, so it just increased the bewilderment and frustration of his enemy. But he had had a chance, he would have had a chance right at that moment to redeem himself, even though he was negatively dedicated, you might say. Yes, and I'm remembering a discussion about Master R. Maybe it was in the Oakley books. There was a chronicler of the life of the Count of Saint-Germain where talked of many of his encounters. There was a man who had a decision in relation to the French Revolution. He had a moment when an integrated choice for the right was offered to him, but he hesitated. He let time pass. And yeah, even though that time was maybe just a few moments, and the Master R said to him, now there is no chance. The time had passed. So we have not to lose a moment. Master M has told us that to steal other people's time, to rob them of their time, is equivalent to murder. I put the other one first. To waste your own time is equivalent to suicide, and to rob time from another person equivalent to murder. So time is of the essence. There is no rush, no hurry, and yet there is no time to lose. And of course, the elemental lives will rear up and incline us to waste time in various ways, but perhaps we can steadily realize that we are in the process of uniting the poles, of joining as a soul with the larger groups of souls, and as groups of souls with still larger groups, that we are part of a great unitive process under the law of magnetic impulse. We are functioning increasingly not under the law of economy, though that must be observed, but increasingly under the law of magnetic impulse, which is the interior aspect. It's the law of attraction expressed in the world of soul. The law of attraction is a huge law. It applies cosmically, but maybe there are higher aspects of the law of magnetic impulse which also express a cosmic interiority in relation to the law of attraction. So we are about the business of union. Cleavage is the cause of misery. Separation is the cause of pain. And we are uniting in joy and eventual bliss with the other aspects of ourselves. This is a law which will lead to, when performed properly, will lead to great joy. So we have to, under this law, lose sight of the lower self in service. And though the personality may be making its claims, it no longer has what we call its ancient authority over ourselves as a soul. And this is the attitude to develop, and recognizing each other as souls, as we come to do, we then begin to not only recognize this spirit of confidence and joy, we begin to cherish it, to love it. We begin to deeply love this spirit of confidence in others and in ourselves as monads. And we have joy in others as souls and in ourselves as a soul, as the one soul. And to cherish this spirit of love, deep and lasting, for each other, not as personalities, but as more authentic beings, as souls, and finally as still more authentic beings, as spirits, indeed, as spirits. Well, so this will be the end of techniques of, not techniques, laws of the soul, webinar commentary number 11, and whatever page we're on here, we're on page 118. So we went from, 113, I think so. I hate to have to go back this way. Yes, 113 to 118. It's not exactly a program that has the proper number of minutes to it. It's a bit shorter, but so Laws of the Soul webinar commentary, and this is page 113 to 118, and we're going to begin Laws of the Soul webinar commentary number 12, and it'll be from 118, and it's going to be the law of service. And I think before we leave this, it would be good for us all to do the great invocation together. Okay, maybe that'll bring it to us. It does. So, we'll do the great invocation. From the point of light within the mind of God, let light stream forth into the minds of men. Let light descend on earth. From the point of love within the heart of God, let love stream forth into the hearts of men. May Christ return to earth. From the center where the will of God is known, let purpose guide the little wills of men, the purpose which the masters know and serve. From the center which we call the race of men, let the plan of love and light work out, and may it seal the door where evil dwells. Let light and love and power restore the plan on earth. Okay, friends, we'll go on to the law of service, and this program has been about 1 hour and 43 minutes long. Not a very regular time, but it is as it is. Okay, we'll see you shortly. Onward.